She said, why? And I said, well, I heard the third grade teacher telling the principal that Wayne Dyer was in her classroom and that he was a scurvy elephant. She said, yeah, I don't know. And she got on the phone and she called the principal, and the principal said, no, that's Wayne. He mixes everything up. She didn't say that he was a scurvy elephant in her classroom. She said that he was a disturbing element in her classroom. So I always pay homage to the scurvy elephants of the world, because I've learned there is probably a karmic debt that we all pay, and each one of us, as we are scurvy elephants in our own life, get a couple of them in our own families later on. That's the one that you can do nothing with. That's the one who's got a mind of their own, and no matter how much you cajole and punish and threaten and so on, they still have got their own mind, and you know after a while that you're wasting your time. You know, that, like, you better stop and be at peace with this person and teach them harmony and maybe step back and learn something from them. One of the great karmic lessons that I've learned is that the one that you can do the least with will make you the most proud. You know, if you can survive them. So if there is a karma to all of this, I think I must have been an axe murderer in a previous life, because I've got eight of them just like that, all right? All of whom have their own mind, and all that do have their own mind, whom I adore and stand back and never try to take it away from them. Because we also learned in our studies, when I was writing What Do You Really Want for Your Children, about how to apply these principles to the raising of children, we discovered that the ones that are raised on blind obedience and are taught to do exactly what they're told and never question anything are the ones who have the highest degree of prejudice as they grow up in their life. And why not? They're taught to prejudge. You know, you're supposed to think this way. You're a Bosnian, you're supposed to hate a Serb. You're a Muslim, you're supposed to hate a Jew. You're a Hindi, you're supposed to hate a Sikh. It's, you know, and then you just you raise them to not think for themselves, to get into this no-think mentality. And so I honor my scurvy elephants. And there was one named Samuel Taylor Coleridge who took on kings and queens and so on up in the eastern part of the United States 100 or so years ago. And this is one of his great poems. And I'd like you to just, as I just say it to you, I'd like you to really banish the doubt. I'd like you to just let it in. Do what we used to have to do in poetry classes when I was studying English literature. They used to tell us that you have to have this willing suspension of disbelief. You know, when you go to a movie theater and there's a two-dimensional screen there, and you know that this is just lights flickering on and off in a screen. It's not real. And you don't go in there and say, well, this is ridiculous. Those are just lights, and those aren't people. And look at this. I can put my hand in their face. You don't do that, because you wouldn't be able to get anything out of it. So what you do is you suspend your disbelief. And you allow yourself for a couple of hours to be entertained. And then you walk out and you say, ah, that was so phony. They didn't do this and those. So while you're in it, so what I'd like you to do for the remainder of time that we have is just suspend that disbelief and just listen to this. This is what Coleridge said. He said, what if you slept? And what if in your sleep you dreamed? And what if in your dream you went to heaven and there picked a strange and wonderful flower? And what if, when you awoke, you held that flower in your hand? Ah, what then? I wonder how many of you know that such a thing is impossible, to bring something from dreaming consciousness into waking consciousness. And if that knowing is so pervasive that you can't allow yourself to entertain the notion that even the least among you can do all that I have done, that you have it within you as a people, as a species. There's a collective unconsciousness in the world. One of the things that I've committed myself to talking about is a very simple thing that what we all came in here knowing today about AIDS. What do we know about AIDS? What do we know? What have we been bombarded with for the past 10 years about AIDS? If you get it, you what? You die. We all know that. You can all say it in unison. And you know, if you took and look inside in the new technology today, you look at an atom, and they have these electron microscopes now where they can literally take an atom and they can take these, you know how they have these electrons and protons and croutons and neutrons and whatever they are that you had to measure when you were in junior high school, remember? You can now take those electrons these little tiny subatomic particles that are hurling around through these massive empty spaces. And you can begin to align them. And as you align them and get them in a line, when you get to what they call a critical mass, when you get to that point, let's say whatever it is, if there's a billion of them in there and you get to 2 million, there's this like invisible force that is inside of this atom that all of a sudden overwhelms the atom, and all of the rest of the electrons in there automatically align. And they call this place, they call this a critical mass. And they call this in quantum physics, they call this phase transition. When you hit the critical mass, all the rest of them through this invisible force begin to align. And quantum physics is nothing more than the study of how things behave at this subatomic level. And what we've discovered is that we're made up of these things. So that when enough of us as a people begin to think in certain kinds of ways and we reach a critical mass, then all the rest of us begin to align that way. And the same kind of changes that take place in the history of humanity in one place take place all over the planet at the same time. Like slavery began to be stopped about the middle of the 19th century, not just in Africa and here, but in Asia and in Indonesia and all over the planet, because the consciousness began to shift that this was no longer something we could tolerate. And as people began to think this way, it's called the 100th monkey effect, where they will take these monkeys and they will teach them how to wash sweet potatoes over here, and all of them will watch each other doing it in what they call allelomimetic behavior, where they will mimic each other. And then when they reach the critical mass, all the rest of them are suddenly doing the same thing. And then they go over to this island over here, 200 miles away, where they haven't even had any contact with the same monkeys and the same species, and they're doing the same thing. That the spread is not a physical property, that it's an invisible property. That indeed we are all connected, but what we're connected with is not something that we can get a hold of. As Deepak always says, quantum physics is not only stranger than you think it is, it's stranger than you can think. Because it indeed, what it does is it shatters the illusion of our separateness.